Paul Musson from Paddington Capital Management. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Paul, you wrote a book entitled Capital Offense, Why Some Benefit at Your Expense. And I want to get into that today. What was your goal with that book?
So my goal was to educate and empower people, particularly people who were not in the investment industry, who are not economists, people who are suffering from our monetary system and from outrageous deficit spending by government. Some are benefiting from that, but most of us are suffering, and the suffering will increase. And the only way to change things, I believe, is by we the people telling policymakers that we don't want this anymore. So policymakers are not bad people. This is not a conspiracy theory. We can go into the specifics of what's been going on and why. You know, I do believe they're good people, but people respond to incentives. You know, as Charlie Munger used to say, tell me the incentive and I'll tell you the action, or something like that.
The outcome.
The outcome, yeah. So, you know, there's an old saying that the people always get the government that they deserve. Now, you know, a few comments on that. You might say instead that the majority get the government that they deserve because they're the ones who voted them in. But that's only true if the government actually does what they said they were going to do in the run up to the election. And it's only true if the people actually understand what's going on. And I don't believe that most of the people do understand what's going on. And so they cannot demand the appropriate actions from our leaders. And if our leaders, policymakers, did the right but difficult thing today, they'd be voted out of office so quick, because that's not what we want. We've been convinced that there is such a thing as a free lunch, that you can get something for nothing. It's a myth. You cannot. If you're taking more out of the system than you are putting in, somebody else is paying for it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. But we don't like to think about that. We like to believe, yes, the government, we can demand these subsidies from the government. We, you know, these sort of payments, entitlement, whatever it is. And so nothing's going to change until we demand it. Or, I mean, the only other way it could change is you have such a catastrophic financial crisis. And I mean, worse than the one that we had in 08 and 09, that then politicians would have no choice. But that would be extremely painful and could result in a massive political change and a shift towards socialism, which would, as bad as it is today, that would be even worse. So my goal with the book is to try and get ahead of all of that. And so we can have what I call like a controlled implosion, where we fix it ourselves. It will not be without pain. There's no way out of this without pain. It's like the rule of holes. You know, when you find yourself in a hole, the first rule is to stop digging. Well, we've been digging faster and faster, and now we're in this enormous hole, and it's going to be very difficult to get out, but we can do it. And because I also believe that the average person is very smart, and particularly when it comes down to what to do with their own hard-earned capital, their own skin in the game. And yeah, so that's the goal with the book.
So at this point, Paul, we're basically, you know, let's say somewhere around 100 years into the use of most of the, let's say, the fiat currencies that we are all familiar with, whether it be the US dollar for us, the Canadian dollar, you know, the Mexican peso, whatever that is. Where do you think we are in the evolution or the life cycle of these fiat currencies?
God knows, and over the last 100 years, the monetary system has changed a few times, right? So, before the First World War, we had the classical gold standard, and which would be great if we went back to that. Between the wars, we had the was it the gold exchange standard, I think it was called, where foreign central banks could not only hold gold, but they could hold either UK sterling or US dollars. And this is where the trouble started. And then in 33, I think it was, Roosevelt took, or he banned individuals from owning gold. So you had to sell your gold to the government. And if you didn't, you could suffer a $10,000 fine, which was a good chunk of change back then, or go to jail for 10 years. And then you had the and then you went to the fixed exchange standard at Bretton Woods in, is that 44 or something like that, 45? And then it changed again in 71 when Nixon finally nixed the completely severed the relationship between money and gold.
It was
Or I
temporary.
should
It was temporary.
Yeah, exactly. I shouldn't say money and gold, dollars and gold, because gold was the money. Dollars just represented the gold. Now dollars have become the money. And people say back then that, the US didn't have any choice to go off the gold standard because countries like France were coming over and taking all their gold back because they didn't want to hold US dollars. And so there weren't enough gold reserves to back the currency, so they didn't have any choice. Well, they did have a choice. The reason France was taking all their gold is because the US was increasing the money supply at such a rapid rate, and they were afraid of, continuous devaluation of their US dollars. So there was a choice there, but they decided not to take it. Now, where we are now in the evolution, we've got to be closer to the end than we are to the beginning. And the current system is not sustainable, even though some economists out there will try to convince you that it is. They try to convince you that debt and deficits don't matter if you can print your own money. It's nonsense. So they can print as much as they want to pay off the debt, but the dollars they're going to be paying you back with are going to be worth a fraction of what they were when you lent them to the government. And so people aren't stupid. And then they say, well, we know what you're going to do. You're going to financially repress us. And so guess what? We want a much higher interest rate if you want to borrow our money, borrow our capital. And then you get yield curve control and all kind of stuff, and the whole thing just goes into the abyss. So I don't know. Nobody knows, right? But and again, it's another reason that I've written a book to try and get ahead of that sort of thing, that sort of outcome, which would be really bad for the average consumer.
Do you think it's hubris to think that we should put a small group of academics in control of capital and really the cost of capital?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no way they can know. Like we were talking before we started recording, I think it was David Ricardo, the great British classical economist, who said that the optimal amount of money in the economy is whatever it is at this moment. Just don't ever change it up or down. And so the economy can grow. The economy does not need money to grow. It does not need the money supply to increase in order for the economy to grow. And so the way it's supposed to work is that you have a stable money supply and the amount of stuff that's being produced keeps growing, then the price of that stuff would steadily decline. It's called good deflation. There's such a thing as bad deflation. That's when the money supply contracts. That's really bad. You don't want that. But if you have stable money, increasing amount of stuff being produced, This is what you had in the last 30 years of the 1800s in the US. You had a slowly growing money supply, just over 4%, I think it was, from 1867 to 1897. And an explosion in productivity. So you had 30 years of slowly declining prices. That's to the benefit of the consumer. So real wages were growing significantly in the late 1800s. Now, again, this is the way the capitalist system is supposed to work. So, you look at flat screen television for or TVs, for instance. A flat screen TV back in the early 2000s was like $3,000. You can get one today for 300, and it's even higher quality. Because when you start, if you start make if you're making excess profitability, it attracts competition. New capital comes in and compete for that consumer, and they do so by producing a similar good, but they lower the price. So that's why over time, profit margins have mean reverted. They haven't for the last 20 years or so, but traditionally, that's why profit margins mean revert. The excess profitability gets competed away, prices come down, even though the quality of the goods are still rising, and the consumer is supposed to benefit from that. So even if you're a flat wage, that your real earnings would be going up every year. But that's not happening because central banks have been increasing the money supply faster than the economy can produce stuff. And so despite all these productivity improvements, the prices of everything is going up and not down. And that's a real disservice and harmful to the average consumer.
So what is the natural rate of interest and also the neutral rate of interest?
So, two very different things which often get conflated. So, the natural rate is that determined by market forces, market players with their own skin in the game. So let's say Apple wants to borrow $10,000 from you. You're going to lend them 10,000. You're looking at the business model and the latest iPhone and blah, blah, blah. You think, you know what? I'm not sure they're going to be able to repeat that next year. So I want 10% interest on the $10,000 I'm going to lend to Apple. But maybe Apple can't afford to pay 10% interest. So the Federal Reserve will say, well, we're going to print money, buy longer dated bonds, and drive interest rates down. So Apple only has to pay 7% instead of 10%. So the natural rate would have been 10%. And that would have been the optimal interest rate. I'm just using Apple as an example. I think it's a good business. But so when you've got millions of people making all these sort of decisions about what to do with their capital, making these risk return assessments, it results in the optimal interest rate that results in the best allocation, most efficient allocation of capital within the economy, results in the most productive economy, the most wealth being created for all people. The neutral rate is very different. So years ago, central banks and politicians started encouraging debt-fueled consumption. And it is sort of the Keynesian model where they believe that consumption is the fount of all economic prosperity. It's not. It's the result of economic prosperity. What drives an economy forward is saving and investment. And then that enables the consumption that we all enjoy. But they look at GDP as the barometer of the health of the economy. All GDP is a measure of all final spending. Consumption or consumers are two-thirds of that. So they think that that's what drives an economy because every time a consumer spends money, it's somebody else's income. But a consumer can only spend if they first created something, given themselves the wherewithal to spend, which we can talk about. So they encourage debt-fueled consumption. There's nothing wrong with debt if that debt is used for productive things like you use it to create capital, or you're buying a house, of course, and that's a consumption good, or buying a car, a big. But if you're using debt for day-to-day stuff, that's eventually going to get cut. It's going to catch up with you. Regardless, this is encouraged. And so people take on debt to keep that GDP number going, but they get to a point where they can't service any more debt. There's too much debt in the economy, so spending starts to flatline because it's being driven by debt. So what central banks do is drive interest rates lower so people can service more debt. And that's what people do. They take on more debt now because the interest rate just went down. Oh, guess what? GDP just picked up. All that is final spending, not more stuff being produced. Then flatlines again because they can't service any more debt. And then you take interest rates down even further. So the neutral rate is the rate of interest that central banks believe results in steady GDP growth without too much inflation. They have this 2% inflation target, which is ridiculous. You don't need 2% inflation target for an economy to grow. It's really bad. So the natural rate, which results in the most efficient allocation of capital and the greatest productivity growth, is here. Central banks have been driving the neutral rate lower and lower, further and further away from the natural rate to keep GDP growing, to keep debt-fueled consumption growing. But it results in worse and worse allocation of capital. The price discovery mechanism of capital markets increasingly distorted. My favorite line in economics is by Ludwig von Mises. He was sort of the king of the Austrian school of economics. And he said that policymakers can deny you the right to receive the natural rate of interest, which is up here, but they can't eliminate its existence. They can't change the fact that this is what leads to the greatest productivity growth in the economy, but they can force everybody to only receive this or pay this.
So in that case, Paul, what is the, let's say, the source or the cause, the main root of inflation?
Money supply. Now, people will try to convince you that, after COVID, it was supply shocks that caused the inflation. And there were some supply issues, of course. But when you look, and I talk about this in my book, and by the way, I'm sort of cutting corners here, but in my book, I go through this step by step, slowly, carefully, and I use everyday language. I don't use the crazy financial jargon because the whole point is for people not in the industry to understand what's going on. I talk specifically about this issue in my book. So when inflation was peaking in the States, and there were like big traffic jams in the ports out in California, and people were saying, well, it's because of COVID and the supply chains aren't working properly. No, that's not what was going on. The numbers of loaded containers coming into the ports in Huntington Beach and LA were going through the roof. They were hitting records. And that's why there was these jams in the ports. People were buying so much stuff because of all the stimulus checks that they couldn't get it through the ports, smoothly or quickly. And so that's what caused the inflation. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it. So they shut down the economy, and I'm not criticizing COVID actions. It was a scary time and everyone was flying by the seat of their pants and nobody knew what the hell to do. So I give them a pass on that. But it doesn't make any sense if you've shut the economy or partially shut the economy to then mail out trillions of dollars of checks to people to go and buy less stuff that's being produced. Well, of course, the price is going to go up. Another example I use in my book, I use like an island economy to help people understand how an economy really works. So there's three people at first on the economy. One catches fish, another collects water, another collects coconuts. And so one fish is exchanged for one coconut, is exchanged for 1 liter of water. So now let's say there's a supply shock in a coconut industry. So Sheila, who's collecting coconuts, she hurt her foot. Now instead of only being able to collect three coconuts per day, she can only collect two. So supply goes down, price normally goes up. So now it used to be one fish for one coconut, but now it's going to be two fish for one coconut, or 2 liters of water for one coconut. So the price of coconuts has just gone up in the economy. But guess what? The price of water and fish has just gone down in terms of coconuts. It's only half a coconut now to buy a fish and half a coconut to buy water. You cannot have a general price increase of sustained general price increase of all goods unless two things happen in this situation. First of all, you have to introduce money into the economy. And second, the quantity of money has to increase faster than the amount of goods being produced. Now, there is another way it could happen. You could have a stable money supply and the amount of goods being produced steadily declining in the economy. Then the price of all those goods would go up as well. But that's not what's happening in the world. It's not what's been happening for decades. The amount of stuff continuously goes up, but the amount of money being produced grows even faster. And that's what causes inflation.
Well, of course, it's a, it's an interesting combination, but it's important to think about the quantity of that capital or that, that fiat currency. Do you make that distinction between capital and money, Paul?
Absolutely. So, and this is another reason why policymakers get away with what they do, and unwittingly so, I would say. It's not a conspiracy theory. I do believe the policymakers think they're doing the right thing, that they do believe that people would benefit by increasing the money supply, driving asset prices higher artificially. They don't. It's terrible for the economy. But it's in large part this happens because people and policymakers, many, don't understand the difference between capital and money. So, capital is what makes the world go round. So, we were talking about earlier before we started recording. So, capital is whatever people produce, either a good or a service. So, you produce a bike, I produce a suit, and then we exchange that with each other. That's direct exchange or barter. And now I've got your bike, you've got my suit. And really importantly, none of this came at anybody else's expense. Anybody else's expense. Nobody was coerced in this situation. There was no bike and no suit in the economy. You created a bike, I created a suit, exchanged it with each other. The economy is that much better off. But we can't do direct exchange. As I said earlier, like how many, because the cost of all the different goods gets too complicated. How many kitchen chairs does it cost to take a flight to Florida? Blah, blah, blah. So instead, we use a medium of exchange called money. So you sell your bike for $1,000, and then use that $1,000 to buy my suit. Now here is where the trouble starts. So you make 10 bikes, you sell them for $1,000 each. Now you've got $10,000, you stick that in your bank account. What that $10,000 effectively represents is the 10 bikes that you created. The capital of your 10 bikes that you produced is temporarily stored up in that $10,000 sitting in your bank account. Now, central bank, but you don't spend it right away. You're going to go on a nice vacation at the end of the year. Before you get a chance to spend it, the central bank doubles the money supply. Now, when the central bank does that, the central bank does not create any capital to obtain that money, just creates that out of thin air. Now, that new money obtains capital, doesn't earn it, it obtains capital as soon as it comes into the economy by taking capital from the rest of the money already in existence. So, as soon as that money comes into the economy, it takes five of the bikes from your $10,000 and puts it into the newly printed money. So, your bank statement still says that you've got $10,000. You're feeling pretty good. But your $10,000 now is only storing five bikes instead of 10. And so, your $10,000 will only buy half as much as it would have done before the central bank doubled the money supply, which is, of course, inflation. So, that trip that you were going to go on that you thought was going to cost you $10,000 is now $20,000. And so now you can't afford it. And that is why my book is called Capital Offense, because authorities take your capital from you without your permission. And this is the third way in which governments obtain capital from you. The first way is through taxation. The second way is by borrowing it from you. And in both cases, they're like above board. I mean, you might say that taxation is too high, definitely too high in Canada. But at least, people can vote for whatever party they think is going to appropriately tax us. Well, it's a lesser of two evils, I guess, in that regard. Or we can decide if we want to lend our money to the government. But the third way they obtain capital is by increasing the money supply. And that we don't vote for. And we don't give them our permission to do that. And so that's why it's called capital offense. And we can talk about other ways in terms of how wealth is redistributed in the economy.
Well, of course, right now, Paul, there's if you have some experience to be trying to invest at this point, it seems like a very daunting task. Gold is at all-time highs. Silver is acting like a rocket ship, way past all-time highs. Stocks are at record highs. Home prices, copper, platinum, money market funds, US debt, deficit spending, household debt. What is that telling us about the value of the currency that we're all used to using, and what is the solution?
Yeah, well, it's telling you that the value of the currency is continuously going down. And people will often talk about, if the US dollar is the exchange rate is going, I mean, it's been going down last year, but if it's going up versus other currencies. So all it means is not that the US dollar is getting stronger, it's just getting weaker at a less rapid pace and all the other currencies. And so long ago, central banks, I believe they sacrificed the mainstream economy on the altar of higher asset prices because they convinced themselves and willingly convinced themselves that driving asset prices higher was good for the economy. That if we take interest rates down to zero, far below the natural rate, and drive stock markets higher, then the benefits of that will trickle down to everybody else. They don't. Or if we drive housing prices higher, that will create a positive wealth effect and people will start spending more money, consumption again, and that won't be good for the economy. It's not. And this is the main problem. This is the main, like, it's short-term something for nothing mindset. The way the economy optimally works is with that natural interest rate, with capital being produced and then saved and then invested, put to productive use. This takes time. This takes effort. It doesn't happen overnight. But this first sign of trouble, usually asset prices declining, central banks will rev up the printing presses and drive asset prices higher. So, you had the dot-com bubble in the 90s, and there was a lot of real productivity growth happening in the 90s, the dot-com era, the internet, and everything. It was really exciting times. But of course, the prices that everybody was having to pay for all that stuff got like crazy. And Cisco Systems, which is, a good company, the share price, I think it just got back to where it was in March of 2000. So it took 25 years because it was so overpriced. And but regardless, those soaring stock prices resulted in a positive wealth effect. And so people were spending more money as the prices of their portfolios were, or values of the portfolios were going higher. Now, there's a such thing as a real wealth effect. So if stock markets are going higher because of more and more capital being produced by companies, their profitability is increasing. They're hiring more people. They're paying them more. There's more good stuff going on. That higher profitability pushes the share price of the company higher. And if all companies and the market are doing that, it pushes stock markets higher. So the stock market is a symptom of what's going on in the, or supposed to be a symptom of what's going on in the economy. Now it's a symptom of how much money is being printed by the central banks, not by how much cap. No, it's not solely because of money printing. There's a lot of good stuff still going on in econ on the economy, but money is having more of, and more of an impact on that. So when the dot-com bubble crashed, it resulted in a negative wealth effect. And so people were spending less. So then you had some market commentators like Paul Krugman of the New York Times and Paul McCulley of PIMCO recommending that the Fed should now create a new wealth effect through the housing market because more people own housing than stocks. And so that should have a bigger wealth effect on the economy. And so Greenspan took the interest rate or the Fed funds rate down to 1%, kept it extremely low for 3 years. Now, these were emergency levels for the Fed funds rate. You would have thought, oh, we must be at war or something. No, and it wasn't even in a recession. 2001 was a very mild recession. It was one quarter of economic decline. So the economy is still growing, yet the central banks, Bank of Canada followed suit, by the way, and interest rates on the floor. And of course, the housing market responded. Lower mortgage rates results in higher demand for housing, and house prices went through the roof. And you had that crazy housing bubble in the 2000s. And just like they expected, it did result in a wealth effect. People were extracting hundreds of billions of dollars of equity from their homes in the States to spend it, and it was good for the economy. It was not good for the economy. It's good for spending, good for that GDP number. Of course, the whole thing came crashing down in the great financial crisis, and there were a number of people who were responsible for this, but the Fed established the conditions for it to all happen. And though, so rather than say to themselves, well, maybe that wasn't a good idea to distort interest rates to try and encourage behavior from people that we thought was appropriate, rather than letting them decide what was appropriate with a natural interest rate. So instead of that, they doubled and tripled down through QE1, 2, and 3, printing trillions of dollars buying mortgage-backed securities and stuff like that. So even worse is that, you know, a ho and it resulted today, many years later, in a housing affordability crisis in the States, terrible crisis in Canada and Australia, where younger people, you know, it's hopeless. They can't even dream of being able to afford a home, start a family. The average age of the first-time home buyer in the States is 40 years old now. I mean, this is terrible. This is a really bad outcome from policy that was, I do believe, well-intended, although arrogant. So a house should not be going up in price, unless it's general inflation, but there shouldn't even be general inflation. A house is not a productive asset. So like I was saying earlier, you know, you produce a bike, I produce a suit, we exchange that, doesn't come at anybody else's expense. We both mutual benefit. That's the way free market capitalist system is supposed to work. You don't benefit at the expense of somebody else. You only benefit if somebody else is benefiting from your actions. So my wife and I live in a suburb of Toronto. And we bought our house in 2001, which just happened to coincide with when Greenspan and then Bernanke started this whole wealth effect nonsense. And so our house today is worth four times what we paid for it. So
Nominally.
nominally, yes. In real terms, it's about 2.5 times. So who out there is also benefiting 2.5 times in real terms, similar to us? There's nobody. Not only that, somebody else is 2.5 times worse off because they have to pay four times nominally for our house what we paid. It's not like our house is not a productive asset. Our house is not producing four times as much stuff as it was in 01. It hasn't grown four times in size. Our house, it's the same economic good that a younger couple or a newcomer, immigrant to our country, has to pay us. So it's a redistribution of wealth from their bank account into our bank account. There's no increased capital in the economy. And so you'll see policymakers talk about this all the time. They talk about record levels of household wealth in America. And no, it's not record amounts of capital. Well, there might be record amounts of capital, but it's nowhere near what they think it is. It's just you're paying a higher price for the same amount of capital that's being produced. So higher stock valuations, higher house prices, that's not increased wealth. That's a redistribution of wealth to asset owners from those who don't own those assets. And it's affected by the printing press.
Well, when we see the, let's say, the advent of variable mortgage rates, the terms of those mortgages getting extended out to, I've seen something like 70 years. We see the 50-year mortgages now in the US. Does this produce a condition that tells us that the housing economy is healthy and that a house is, one of the best investments that you can make, as we've heard many times in the past?
Yeah, so the answer is no. And the a house should not be considered an investment. Not one that should grow. It is a great piggy bank, if you will. It's a great forced saving. So when you the way it used to work, of course, is that you'd buy a home, take out a mortgage. You pay that mortgage off as quickly as you could to reduce the amount of interest expense that you're paying to the bank over the life of the mortgage. And then when you paid it off, you could fund your retirement with that nest egg, which was the equity in your home. And what that equity in your home represents or represented was the amount of capital that you produced and have now stored up in your home. So if you made bikes for your career, every time you sold a bike, you get that money, you pay off part of the mortgage. And then, so effectively, you've got thousands of bikes stored up in the value of your home. And now you can use that to fund your retirement. And so, so that's a pretty good thing. But it should not be considered an investment, because I just said earlier, it's not a productive asset. And so, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say about it.
What do you see as some of the solutions in order to, let's say, build wealth or account for this devaluation, at this time?
Well, be careful. the problem is that we like it or not, we have this system, and so you got to figure out how you can carefully grow without losing it all if it all comes undone. And and that's not easy. So what I do, and this is not investment advice, right? I'm not licensed to give investment advice. But I used to be a manager of mutual funds, and our investment style was and is to invest in very high quality businesses that have a sustainable competitive advantage that we can identify and also operate with a very strong balance sheet. So even if these companies are faced with a very challenging economic situation in the future, they will probably survive and possibly take advantage of other companies not surviving and use that as an opportunity to take market share or whatever. So with a long enough time horizon, even in a really bad situation, those companies will probably get me on side and help grow my wealth. And then I also have gold in my portfolio. And my gold holding, I don't consider it an investment. I consider it more of a hedge. So, obviously central banks can't print gold. And so it retains its value much better than a dollar does. Now, there's a couple of scenarios where gold could do really well. I mean, it's already done very well. Actually, I have a free blog called Paul-itical Economy. It's my first name, Paul, and then itical economy. People can sign up for it on a website. I talked about it in my last post. There's a report by Mermican. I don't know if you've ever read their stuff. So
Yeah, no, for
the latest one is talking about the fact that they think that 2025 was just the very beginning of a gold bull market. And so you can read the report, or you can read my blog to see the reasons for that or why they think that. Yeah, and maybe I'm not saying that it is, but they're pretty smart guys. So if policymakers do take the easy path, i.e., the wrong one, then they will resort to financial repression and you will be repressed and there'll be yield curve control and the money supply will increase. And in that, that's terrible for the economy, terrible for the average consumer, but it would be good for gold. If they decided to do the right thing and finally stop exploding the money supply higher, stop attempting to drive asset prices higher at the expense of the mainstream economy, they went to a hard currency and they went to a gold standard, that obviously would be very good for gold as well. Now, ironically, if they went to a fiat standard hard money, so we have a fiat standard now. There's nothing wrong with a fiat standard per se. What's wrong with a fiat standard is that it is so easily abused by policymakers. But if they fixed that and they changed the rules and they went to Milton Friedman, I think he recommended 3 to 5% annual increase in the money supply or something like that. I still think that's too much. But it'd be a hell of a lot better than what we've experienced over the last number of decades. Or if they went with a stable fiat money supply, that would be very good for the economy, but that would not be good for gold. But that's why I consider my gold as a hedge. So I'm participating in the nonsense as carefully as I can via investing in Ivy mutual funds, which invest in very high quality businesses. So if this nonsense goes on for another 10 or 15 years, I'm going to be participating in growing my wealth and trying to keep ahead of inflation. But if it ends, an uncontrolled, out of control explosion, the businesses that I'm invested in will go down, but they'll hold in better than the average company, hold in better than the stock markets on average, and my gold will, probably do quite well. If it's a controlled implosion, it depends on which path policymakers take. But either way, I think hopefully I'll still get there. So I'm trying to carefully grow and protect at the same time. And I've got some cash as well and some high interest savings vehicles and stuff like that. And I keep it very simple.
Do you see a risk for the average person keeping money in a savings account or in the bank?
Well, you mean like an inflation risk or insolvency risk?
Most people that are going to listen to this, let's say this is a kind of a beginner level lesson of how to deal with capital, how to deal with money, what we normally use. What we normally call money. So if somebody is, let's say, paralyzed by the plethora of options there are out there, cryptos and stocks and all of these things, it is very overwhelming. So if they're just keeping money in, let's say, a savings account or in their bank, how do you, or what advice would you give that person that is keeping that money in a bank account?
Yeah, so The obvious risk is I don't think there's a solvency risk. I mean, there could be of Canadian banks, or American banks. Well, I guess there were American banks, but when Silicon Valley went bust back in 2023, there was only supposed to be $250,000 FDIC insurance, well, not deposits, but they again they broke the rules and bailed everybody out. So solvency is probably not a concern. It's more about inflation and the interest rate that you're receiving on your bank account not being enough to offset the money printing. And it's kind of a joke. Well, no, not kind of, it is a joke. Like in the US, the Federal Reserve is paying banks interest on reserve balances, these trillions of dollars that the central bank created. They're paying interest rates on those reserve balances, which are completely risk-free to the banks. And it's far higher than the interest rate that banks will pay consumers when they deposit their money in the banks. I mean, this is a joke. So, first thing I would do is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having some cash. You want that sort of optionality. Try and find yourself some sort of high interest rate vehicle. Honestly, I would talk to a financial advisor. And so, I said an investor for most of my career, and my clients were financial advisors, either stockbrokers or financial planners. And there are lots of amazing financial advisors out there, very smart people who take great care in shepherding, if you will, like their clients through their financial journey and investing according to their own risk tolerance and stuff like that. And then just educating yourself. But it's tough. It can be intimidating. To your point, there's so many different vehicles out there, crypto, whatever. And I don't participate in any of that other stuff, not because it wouldn't necessarily be good for me, but I'm quite comfortable doing what I'm doing. I like where my money is already, and I like to keep things as simple as possible. And I like to understand exactly where my money is. And that was sort of our motto when we were investing in businesses. If we couldn't figure out what the competitive advantage was, if we didn't have confidence in the corporate culture, couldn't figure it out, then we would just walk away. And so know where your money is. Don't believe in the something for nothing myth. Don't believe in these free lunches and if it seems too good to be true, it usually is. All these sayings, they survive for a reason. And yeah, I mean, that's what I would do. I mean, but it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough when your starting point is record highs in stock markets. History at least will show you that when you are investing in the S&P 500 at these valuations, your 10-year return, even in nominal terms, probably be net. Historically, it's been negative or flat at best. So in real terms, you're losing money. Doesn't mean it's going to happen over the next 10 years because central banks have tied their reputation to higher asset prices. And so if stock markets do start to tumble, they will want to come storming back with more QE. The only thing that will stop them is if inflation is getting out of control. And so that's sort of where we are. That's what's happened. It seems to be happening in Japan finally. I mean, it's outrageous what's going on in terms of interest rates going up in Japan. I never thought I'd see interest rates this high in Japan, especially with 250% debt to GDP. And yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens over the next number of years. It will end because it's not sustainable. Nobody knows when it's going to end. I think it was Keynes who said that markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent, right? You can look at something and you learn this as an investor. Well, that doesn't make any sense. That's going to end pretty quickly. And it doesn't. It just keeps going and going and going and going. And you're pulling your hair out. That's why I have no hair left. And yeah, so I don't know what's going to happen. Well, actually, I do think I know what's going to happen. I just don't know when.
So, Paul, what do you think is the, let's say, the point of gaining capital and growing your investments? How have you used it in your life to create meaning?
Well, I think when I started out, I didn't really think about it in those terms. I thought about it. I just thought about what it is I wanted to do. And it wasn't until quite late in life that I realized I wanted to be an investor. And, I just thought, wow, what a great way to make a living. This is going to be so much fun. And I didn't know exactly what my career path was going to look like, and it was sort of an unconventional path, shall we say. And I just kept following that dream, if you will, doing what I love to do. And then with that came capital. So in a free market capitalist system, as I may have said before, any capital wealth that you have is supposed to be a reflection of capital and wealth out there that somebody else also has. So you create a capital, you exchange it with others, and now you have their capital and they've got your capital. So that's why, like, I never wanted anything that I didn't earn. It's just sort of a mindset I had many, many years ago when I was younger. I didn't want to live at anybody else's expense, either financially. I didn't want to harm people in any way, emotionally, financially, nothing. I just wanted to know that whatever I had is because I created it. No one suffered from it. And so I just had that mindset. And then I just started moving forward and trying not to be a burden on anybody. And then this was the result. I didn't think about, oh, I want this much capital. Now, don't get me wrong, I love having capital. Capital's great to have. Financial security is a great thing. And when you're worrying about how you're going to pay the bills and if you've got debt, that's a terrible thing. And I used to be in that situation. I know what it's like to not have any money, to not have any capital. It's not much fun. When I moved to Toronto in 1990, I had no job, and I was literally sleeping on a hardwood floor of a bachelor apartment. And my first job was in a video store. And I was 29. That's how I got my start. But I'll contradict myself here, maybe. I didn't have any capital at that time, but you would have been hard pressed to find a happier guy in Toronto than me. Now, I eventually got capital, so maybe I wouldn't have stayed happy if I kept sleeping on the floor, of course. But you got to be careful. Capital is great to have. Wealth is great to have. But, life is also happening right now. And you don't want to sacrifice too much of, what's going on your life on a day-to-day basis in order to try and accumulate capital in the future. So you want to strike that balance. And I remember one of my clients, she financial advisor. And we're talking about how important it is to a financial advisor. They help people to be disciplined and save and invest carefully. Because we all know these stories about people who made a fortune and they blew it all and they got nothing left for their retirement. So she told me this story about this advisor or her client who worked, he worked in the auto industry. And And he passed away in his 80s, but he's a very good saver. And so his wife had no idea about the state of their finances. So the advisor was saying, I couldn't wait for her to come into the office. I was going to tell her how secure she was financially. So the client comes in, the advisor says, okay, first of all, you got no mortgage. Your husband paid off the house. And you've got over $1 million in the bank or investments or whatever. You're not going to have to worry about anything financially for the rest of your life. Her client starts crying. So she was upset. Why are you upset? She said, all I ever asked him for was 2 weeks in Florida. Wouldn't spend the money. So you want to strike that balance, long-winded way of saying you want to strike that balance of live for today, do the right thing, do things that you like, be careful, don't believe in the something for nothing myth. And there's no guarantees, but I think, you've got a good chance of skating on side.
Well, Paul, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. I hope this was useful for those that that do listen to it. Of course, the name of the book again is Capital Offense: Why Some Benefit at Your Expense. And of course, your blog and a bunch of your material is all available at paddingtoncapitalmgmt.com. Paul,
And
thank you so much for your time today.
thanks, Tom. It's been great.